Welcome to the Irish Tech News Podcast, where we will bring you some of the most interesting interviews and features from the world of tech. Visit irishtechnews.ie and check out our podcast section to explore all of our previous episodes. You can subscribe to our podcast using whatever your favorite app or service is by visiting anchor.fm/irish-tech-news.
This week on The Futurists, Peter Chatty.
So I'm very optimistic in young minds who are going to take everything that we're dealing with today and are reimagining what life should be that is more like less heads down and digital and less like social media and less and more interactive and actual tangible living with each other and active relationships with real people looking up rather than just looking down.
Hey there, welcome back to The Futurists. I'm Rob Tursik. I am the co-host. This week, my co-host Brett King is flying around the world, as he usually is. And I wanted to get this show in because I'm going to be at an event in New York, and our guest today is going to be joining me at that event. I thought it'd be a lot of fun to post something as a kind of preview for the event in New York that's coming up in a couple weeks. One of the things that I love about the show, and I know Brett does as well, is we occasionally get to meet people and connect with people through this show who we've always wanted to talk to, people we've been aware of for a while. And the great thing about having a podcast is you can reach out to someone and say, hey, please join me on the show. And our guest today is somebody I've been reading his work for quite a while. I've been impressed by. He used to write for Forbes. Now he writes for The Wrap. He's an expert in the media business. He's very insightful about the future of media and telecommunications and entertainment. And lately, he's had a lot to say about artificial intelligence, particularly generative AI. So I want to give a big, huge welcome to Peter Chatty, who's the CEO, the chairman of Creative Media. And as I say, he's been covering this beat for some time. So Peter, hey, welcome to the show. Welcome to The Futurists.
Yeah, great to be here, Robert. Thanks for having me.
I've enjoyed our exchanges on the web, and I'm thrilled to be able to do it with you now on Zoom and on this podcast. And then in about 10 days, we'll be doing it live on stage in New
York. Absolutely. Look,
I
right back at you about I've been reading your stuff. I've known about you. And it's great that we finally get back together or finally get together because we haven't really connected before other than exchanging comments. And, you know, we differ on many things, but we respectfully differ and you have great points and that's the way it should be. So I love
that. That's exactly it.
We have a lot of great ground to cover today.
Yeah, you can learn from people. I mean, that's actually supposed to be the good thing about the web. Unfortunately, so much of social media has degraded into a cesspool. So unfortunately, that's harder to do than it used to be. But anyhow, I've enjoyed our engagement on the web and now we get to do it in person. So on May 20, Peter and I will be on stage for a live debate about artificial intelligence. And there we'll be talking about the impact of AI and the potential benefits of AI for the motion picture business. But there's so many topics that he and I want to compare notes on and talk about and maybe thrash through that we thought, why don't we do it on this podcast? Because we have an open mic. We can go into all sorts of topics, even the stuff that we won't be covering in New York.
We're going to vamp. Yeah, we'll be organic.
So first off, Peter, why don't you, by way of introduction, let people know what it is you do at Creative Media and your background in the media business. Yeah. I think that's a good starting point.
Yeah, when you've been around the block as long as I've been, you know, you don't want to go too long in terms of the introduction, but I'll go very short. I'll hit the kind of the main data points. Started off as an entertainment IP lawyer back in the day at a major firm. Kind of, you know, a traditional sort of way to start. If you love entertainment and you don't have a connection in and you're a Midwestern guy, that's what you do. So it was a great gig. I'm proud to say my biggest client was the group NWA, and that group led me to my wife. And now here we are 30 years later. So NWA led me to love, which I love. I love that.
Okay, shortage of challenges dealing with their content. I'm sure as an attorney, you were pretty busy on the defensive side, at least.
Yeah, it was a big First Amendment case, actually. But that's another story. And then I transitioned into the studios because that's what the dream was for me. I really wanted to be in the belly of the beast. And so I first went to New Line Cinema. It was a legal affairs guy doing motion picture deals and that kind of thing. But then ultimately became a deal guy. So on the business end. And so when I got to Universal, I was there for 4 years and I was SVP, general counsel. And although I had the GC kind of moniker for my operating division, I was really the deal guy. So the two of us did all the deals from a dollar to multi-billion dollar international joint ventures. And then, and a lot of partnerships. And then internet 1.0. I'm an entrepreneur by heart. I left, took the big gamble, made a really stupid move, but that led me to a very smart move. And that's what brought me down from LA to San Diego, actually, where I am. And it was a company called Music Match. And Music Match was on everybody's computers. And essentially, we invented on-demand streaming before there was a Spotify, before anything. So my team and I negotiated the first major and indie label streaming licenses back in the day. We sold to Yahoo for $160 million. I ran another company which did this, what we're doing today, which was social video chat, but it was great IP, but with no business model. So they brought me in to build that. I ran the company. We sold it to Logitech, had a nice result there. Ran Sorensen Media after that. So for 4 years, did not have an exit on that one. Got a little bit tired of running companies. And so for the last 10 years, I'm involved in a lot of different things across sure. media, entertainment, and tech. Deal maker, connector, advisor, sometimes a external general counsel. Sometimes I do that. And then, although I'm not a journalist, you know, as you said, I try to synthesize because I've been in the belly of beast of traditional, but also technology, and try to see where the puck is going. And that's what I write about.
And that's a good setup for today's discussion, because I read a couple of the pieces that you wrote. I read some of the things you shared on LinkedIn as well.
Yeah.
And folks, if you haven't connected with Peter on LinkedIn, do it, because if you're interested in this topic, he shares a lot of good stuff there. And a couple of those things, I was like, hang on a second. And that's where this began. That was the
more
original
than a couple, point. But I...
So one way to summarize what you've done is that you've worked on many situations where traditional media has been confronted with digital media, either working for a big studio or big label, or on the other side of the table where you're at a startup company trying to license in that content and find a kind of constructive, maybe productive or profitable way to work with those traditional companies. And that's a difficult process. I mean, I've done similar things in my career, so I'm familiar with that process. Not everybody gets what the new medium can do. Not everybody understands how it's going to impact their existing business. Sometimes they're fearful. Sometimes they're defensive. So there's a lot of like heightened emotion around that. And these days, the heightened emotion seems to be focused primarily on one topic and one topic only. We've had it on this show so many times. We can't avoid it. It's like this sticky bear that sticks to us. It keeps coming up. It's generative AI.
Yeah.
Generative AI is so profoundly impactful and such a big difference from what we've expected from analytical AI or predictive AI in the past. It's such a difference from that quite a few people find themselves reacting to it. And you see all sorts of different reactions. But quite a few companies are reacting in a very negative way because they're like, hang on a second. That's our content. You trained your model on our content. You got to show us the money. Tell me a little bit about that and what you've experienced from your perspective.
Yeah, I mean, look, because I was at the major studios, I certainly understand the DNA of the people within them. Typically, I hate to generalize, but typically. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason why I left and went into the tech forward media world is because, as I said, I'm entrepreneurial, I'm curious about these things. And I felt that major media companies were moving too slowly to grasp new opportunities. That was part of the reason why I left. So I completely get that kind of thinking. Because I come with that, and you know, like as an example, I host a major music podcast where I interview iconic artists like Blondie, Pink Floyd, et cetera. And I bring that in because I'm very close to artists too. So mm-hmm. I think my soul is very art driven. You know, that's my DNA. So bringing all these things.
For the people who are listening, you can't see Peter's guitars lined up behind him or my paintings behind me. So yeah, we're two artistic guys. We're all for artist rights. Yeah. Keep going. I'm going to bust in here periodically.
No, totally. First of all, anything that changes the status quo is going to be scary because there is something new. And so what I tell people all the time, and you know, I've told you this the other day, my perspective, although I take strong opinions, is I try to be stoic about things. They are where they are. So how you can't control that which is around you, but you can control how you react to it. Mm-hmm. So when there's new technology, there's instant fear for sure, because there has been an effort to really educate oneself to understand, okay, there's these risks, there's new opportunities. And typically whenever there's new technology coming on, and you and I've seen it from the beginnings of time, that it follows the same kind of arc where there's this immediate reaction to kind of shut it down, that we don't want to deal with this But once it's here, you have to deal with it. And there's going to be positive ramifications, but there will certainly be negative ramifications to the status quo. So if you have a job that is going to be impacted, of course you're fearful of it. Understandably, it's human to be that, but how can you react to it? And that's really where I come from. So I take strong opinions about not how, so I'll kind of preface it this way. With generative AI, I find it terribly exciting and terribly daunting at the same time. So, you know, of course, it's going to create, from a creative standpoint, new ways, new art forms, new ways to create, you know, something that doesn't, it doesn't mean that it's either or. It will just be expanded palettes of creativity, yeah. Right?
So, and for people who aren't particularly expressive today, let's say, you know, half the population of the planet is not a good writer, right? ChatGPT makes it possible for a mediocre writer to become a little bit better.
Yeah.
That's an unqualified good, right? That's a benefit for humanity because God knows we got enough incoming email that's poorly written. I wouldn't mind if everybody upgraded their writing style a little bit. Well, so there's some good. And it's important to underscore that because too often in this town, in Los Angeles, what we hear about is the negative aspects. Tell me about the negative aspects. Who's getting harmed by this?
Okay. So I would even call it the negative aspects. I don't look at it that way. I see it as there is value creation. There's, you know, value contribution and value creation. So a new technology comes in and there is new value that's unlocked because of it.
Yeah.
But there's contribution to be able to enable to create that value. So if we're fast forwarding about our discussion about generative AI and what we probably disagree on is that, and I'd love to go through a quick history lesson about why I feel this way, which is you have this breakthrough technology that nobody knows where it's really going to go. And it is only functional if it has the necessary ingredients on which to train to enable it to create the value that we're talking about. And the ingredients are all this, you know, millions and millions of copyrighted works that have been sucked into the vortex. And that has been done without consent and that's a necessary ingredient for this technology to have real value. So it's not saying technology bad. It's just saying that I've seen this now for decades of what happens. There's a new technology that comes on. There's value, contribution, and creation, and big tech has been the net winner on that. That's the way I see it.
That's certainly true. Big tech has been on the winning side of this for 30 years. You and I have seen it. And
totally.
The media companies are frankly on their back foot right now. You know, they're taking a beating. Now, the analogy, when I'm listening to you talk, the analogy I jump to is Napster, because I think a lot of people do. They say, oh, this is just like Napster. It's like file sharing. It allows people to steal content. I don't buy that. I don't buy that argument even a little bit, because I don't think that's what people are doing with generative AI. I don't think they're stealing content. We are talking about the unpermissioned use of copyrighted work. That's definitely a factor. You mentioned that. You know, there may be a great argument for licensing, a fee paid to use that, but there's a bunch of issues around that as well. So let's start by thinking about this. Let's start with the training side, the input side, how these systems are trained. And then later we'll get to the output side. Like, what can I create with that? Because I think that's a useful distinction for the folks who are listening. What that means is when you start to build a generative artificial intelligence, you begin with training data, huge amounts of training data. That's the first step. And then that training data is used to train a model, which is basically like, you know, the AI is reading all the books, or it's looking at all the images, or it's listening to all the music. And then that model begins to build parameters, which are mathematical representations of whatever it's interpreting, whatever it's hearing, whatever it's seeing. And there's a big question about this. Is it fair use? Is it okay to look or read or listen? There is no law that prohibits reading a book, right? There's no law that says you can't learn by looking at a picture. So tell me about that. What's your response when I say that?
Yeah. So first of all, I was a law clerk for a federal judge. So I saw what it was like, how law was made. I think, first of all, when people think of the law, they think that these are set in stone sort of things that are like right and wrong. But
not copyright.
Yeah, exactly. So there's guidance, and a lot of the guidance is probably wrong in the way that you and I would view it intellectually. Mm-hmm. But certainly context matters. And so if nothing else, if you read Supreme Court opinions, it will say context matters when you're talking about fair use analysis.
Yeah.
Fair use, essentially, like at the very high level, we're talking about fair use is intended to be a defense against infringement that is because it promotes a net positive good for society, essentially.
That's kind of
what fair use is.
And that goes to the core copyright. I mean, that's the whole intention behind copyright, back to, you know, Madison writing the Constitution. The purpose of copyright isn't to protect publishers' margins or business models. The purpose of copyright is to advance society. And we do that by making it possible for people to have access to content. And let me just offer this, because people don't understand the concept of fair use. And it's denigrated constantly by the media companies because they're trying to roll back fair use. And it's been expanding at their expense. The point of fair use is simply this. When someone writes a book or comes up with a novel, new work, society needs a way to integrate that. Society needs a way to process it or deal with that information. And to do that, they have to talk about it. They have to be able to comment on it. They have to be able to write critiques or criticism, maybe a parody. Society needs a way, in other words, an escape valve to work with that material. So even if someone has a copyright, it's not an absolute absolute monopoly. There's a built-in flexibility. This is the gray area you're just talking about in the law. Yeah. And this concept of fair use was actually not spelled out in the original copyright laws. It evolved over time in the 19th century in a series of court rulings, and then eventually was codified into law in 1976, Copyright Act. But prior to that, it had just been really a series of precedent cases where judges were like, well, we got to have a little wiggle room here so society can deal with this and process that. So that looks somehow like, wait a minute, it's like you're driving my car without my permission. It feels like you stole my car. But you haven't stolen the car. Nothing's being stolen here. And this is where it's very different, I think, from Napster, where I might, you know, and if I were using Napster, I could file share, which is essentially stealing the music file. In this case, we're talking about unpermissioned use, which is more like trespassing, like somebody, you know, cutting a corner on my neighbor's lot, walking through a neighborhood lot to cut a shorter path across the block. That's not the same thing as stealing. You know, the owner of the property still has it. The New York Times still has all of their content. Nobody's stolen their content, even though that's what they're arguing. Can you respond to that a little bit in the context of fair use?
Yeah. First of all, by the way, you sound like a lawyer. I mean, that's really good, because
I care deeply about this issue because I think fair use is misunderstood. And I also think that the public domain is super important for artists, and people forget that the public domain belongs to all of us.
Yeah.
So I think that the longer we extend copyright, the more stuff we're taking out of the public domain. That's a cost to all of us, right? If we're not creators or writers.
All right. But okay. So this is where
you go.
I'm going to give you some historical examples.
Yeah, go.
And then I'll get into directly your question about generative AI. So you mentioned Napster, and I was there. Like I was in the belly of the beast. I was right there when I was president of Music Match. And I saw what was happening in, you know, the decimation of it all. And I remember there was a guy named Michael Robertson, who's down here in San Diego around me with mp3.com. And I think it was Michael or somebody else who essentially, individuals on Napster were doing one thing, but there were certain companies that were essentially creating banks of songs in the sky, in the cloud.
That's what he was doing at mp3.com. Yeah, he basically said, if you can prove you bought the disc by sticking it in the drive, then we can validate it and you can stream it. It seemed like a reasonable thing, but they got shut down by the record.
They got shut down. And the reason why is because rather than the individual, this was the rationale, rather than the individual doing something, it was a commercial enterprise that was doing this kind of massive copying to put it out there. And even though there was verification that somebody had bought it, that was kind of what the issue was. So when you look at what's happening, that is relevant to, you look at whenever we have these discussions on the law, there's two big cases that people talk about. I'm not going to get into the weeds on them, but one is called Google Books. And Google Books was when Google did its big project where it essentially wanted to be the index for the library of the world. So ingesting, like literally copying all the books around the planet to make them indexable so that we could search and then find snippets of them. And then you could only find snippets of them, but there you discovered the writer and you would need to go out and buy the book from the writer so the author would be compensated. So it was a net good. That's what the court decided. And so if you think of the logic there, what Google did, although they ingested everything line by line by line, which is very relevant here, it was seen as a positive good because it actually benefited the creators and put money in their pockets. The fundamental difference, what's going on with generative AI at a very high level, is that you have, like, let's take the New York Times case against OpenAI and Microsoft. You have all of New York Times articles and features, not just news, feature stories and such, that they've invested hundreds of millions of dollars in doing, in building over time.
Right now, you're basically parroting their complaint, just for the benefit of our audience.
Keep going. But it's the reality, though, too. It's the reality. And it was a really well-done complaint, but there's a point to it. The point is that generative AI, there's a very strong argument that could be made that if you're OpenAI or any one of these, you want to be the place where everybody gets your information, gets their information, no matter what it is. And so at a very high level, we can go deeper than this, but this is different than what we saw in Google Books. Here we have market substitution. And market substitution is something that the U.S. Supreme Court just recently talked about in another case that I'm not going to get into the weeds about, but
the Andy Warhol Goldsmith case.
Exactly. Yep. And so, which is also known as the Prince case. And so the fundamental question, and I think this is important for everybody to understand out there, this is not about this is not about anti-tech or pro-big media. What it's about is essentially taking the value that's been created, the contribution, the ingredients necessary for that value to have been created, and just sharing in the pot of the opportunities in some kind of equitable fashion. And what has happened here so far is that big tech went on this roll, and they tried licensing with some, and there's more of that going on, which also shows that if they feel there's a need to license, well, they know that they need to license. But they went on this roll, and all this value has already been built up. Here's where you and I differ. Right now, we both agree there's going to be some kind of licensing scheme and compensation, that is the right thing to do for the ingredients of taking in all these copyrighted works so that the creators are compensated. But where we differ is that here we are, Robert, there's already been tremendous billions and possibly trillions of dollars of value that have been created by not compensating artists. So what do we do about the past? What do we do about the value that's already been created into OpenAI and all the others? That's a fundamental question.
Yeah, hang on one sec. So that was a helpful overview. And for the folks who aren't familiar with it, the cases Peter's mentioning are kind of the linchpin cases. I asked him in advance to tell us what are the cases we should be paying attention to. The Google Books case happened around 2005. And that case was tried, and then it was appealed, and then it was affirmed, and then the Supreme Court decided not to hear a further appeal. So they basically let it sit at the second district court at the appeal level, where it was found in favor of Google. And essentially, the way the tech industry interprets that is, hey, if there's content on the internet, it's okay for me to scrape the web, and I can use that data freely. Exactly. Now, that is not exactly what that ruling says, but nevertheless, that's kind of like the general interpretation.
And by the way, one important point on that, too. It is Second Circuit Court of Appeals. Cert was denied, and so it is not a Supreme Court ruling.
Right, so there's no Supreme Court ruling. That's true. And Peter's been very eloquent in saying that means it's likely one of these current cases is going to go to the Supreme Court. We don't know which yet. There are 16 different cases that we're tracking, so it's a complicated scenario. Each one has different fact patterns, different defendants, and so we can't make a generalization about any of those, but it's very likely one or more is going to go to the Supreme Court. But let me round off on the last piece before we take a break here. What Peter just jumped to, which I think is so helpful because it's very efficient, is what's at stake here is licensing revenue. And it's very clear. If you look at the complaint from New York Times complaint against OpenAI and Microsoft, they make reference to the fact that for months, the Times has, I'm quoting them right now. For months, the Times has attempted to reach a negotiated settlement with the defendants. A little further down, it says the Times' goal during the negotiations was to ensure that it received fair value for the use of its content. So for the folks who are listening who think that copyright battles tend to be about, the rights of artists, or some sort of moral right for an artist to have some control over their expression, their creative works, and so forth. That's not what this is. This is about money. At the end of the day, what this is going to boil down to is a settlement.
Okay, I got to stop you there. I got to stop you there, though. Yes, of course it's about money, but of course it's about control. If I'm a creator, and again, I've led tech-forward media companies. So I love technology. I love it, but you have to respect the artist. And part of being an artist is that you have control. You have control over your creation. And so, yes,
yeah, but that's not exactly true. And you know this. Copyright has all sorts of loopholes where people have the ability to use it.
Yes, but then that's what we're talking about. How can it be used?
Yeah. And the fact is, the way we settle this is in court. Like, you have to sue somebody and you have to figure out what a judge. Honestly, I mean, like, it's not elegant. Exactly. It's not pretty. It's the way we do it in this country.
It's the way we do it. And the answers are not necessarily pretty nor logical. But
no, also, and they differ. So that's when it goes to the
exactly.
Supreme Court.
Like, if you were the Supreme Court, you and I would be probably come up with different kind of solutions than what this court's going to ultimately
this
decide.
This particular Supreme Court, which is probably outside the scope of today's discussion. Yes. But yeah, I don't think anyone can bet on how the Supreme Court's going to rule on anything, including existing precedents. Okay, on that note, let's take a little break. I'm talking to Peter Chatti, and he is the chairman of Creative Media. We're talking about the generative AI lawsuits brought by the media companies against the big tech companies. Hang on, we'll be right back here on The Futurists.
Provoked Media is proud to sponsor, produce, and support The Futurist podcast. Provoked.fm is a global podcast network and content creation company with the world's leading fintech podcast and radio show, Breaking Banks. And of course, its spin-off podcasts, Breaking Banks Europe, Breaking Banks Asia Pacific, and the FinTech Five. But we also produce the official Finovate podcast, Tech on Reg, Emerge Everywhere, the podcast of the Financial Health Network, and Next Gen Banker. For information about all our podcasts, go to provoke.fm or check out Breaking Banks, the world's number one FinTech podcast and radio show.
Hey, welcome back to The Futurist. I'm Rob Tursik. This week, I'm flying solo because my co-host is in London. Brett King, we miss you. Brett's got a big question for you. Peter Chatti is our guest. And Peter, Brett's question, he shot this across to me in a text message. He was like, are copyright laws even relevant today, or do we need something entirely different to govern digital media?
So first of all, I think that anything that we create is going to be artificial. So is copyright law and the evolution of it good enough to at least provide some kind of framework for the kind of discussion that we're talking about and ultimate policies that we believe, the direction that we follow? I would say yes. I would say that the basic parameters of copyright and fair use and at least some guidance. But again, this gets back to what you and I talked about. These are just guidance, and context is always underscored as mattering. And mm-hmm. So when either of us predict what a court will decide in this case, we have no way of knowing, because this is an entirely different kind of context. And so when you get into some of the questions, which I'm sure we'll just get into now, they haven't been addressed specifically like this, but I'll give
and
you
part of the curveball is that technology keeps changing, right? Ever since the invention of the player piano, with 100 years ago, this has been a wild roller coaster ride for the courts. Because technology keeps throwing curveballs at what was originally intended to be a way to protect the rights of book authors who publish a book. And in those days, back in the very earliest days of the Republic, copyright only covered the book, right? And maps and charts. Like, that was it. Those were the three things covered by it. But what it didn't cover is even like a translation, this notion of like a derivative work. That's a new thing that came out through copyright litigation over time. Initially they said, no, if somebody translate your books into French or German, that's a different work. And so it's not covered. Today, of course, it is. So there's this concept of derivative works. There's also a concept of different types of media. So now copyright's been extended to things like, there was a period 100 years ago, it was very contentious whether a photograph could be qualified for copyright, because it was like, well, all you're doing is pointing this machine at this, at a landscape. You're not really doing anything creative. And over time, the courts were persuaded, the Copyright Office was persuaded that there was some artistic merit to that. And then, of course, the media landscape keeps changing. The way we transmit and share and consume content changed. So now we have this very complex stew. And that's what makes these conversations so interesting. And the tech company keeps throwing curveballs at us. What this all boils down to me, is this one key question. When this all first arrived, I started out with an assumption, because I live in Los Angeles, I work with media companies, I thought, this is copyright infringement on a massive level, until I heard this argument. I thought it was very compelling. They said, hey, Rob, If you read the New York Times, and let's say you read Wirecutter a couple of years ago, and I asked you in an email, hey, what did Wirecutter recommend as the best microwave back in 2020? And I said, oh, from memory, I'm like, my recollection is that they recommended this Panasonic model. And I'm making it up. That might not be the right example. But the point I'm making here is that is not copyright, right? So if I report what I recall, what I learned from reading the New York Times, I'm allowed to summarize it. That's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. If I summarize it in my own words, now if I copy verbatim what the New York Times wrote, that's problematic. And then, of course, if I did that for profit, I create a whole new issue. So there's a bunch of topics we're going to want to get into.
Sure.
But let me get to the heart of this issue right now, which is, what is copying? You've written that these technology companies are copying content on a wholesale level when they train their LLMs. But what the technology companies will insist is that they do not retain any copies. They are reading, or in the case of pictures, they are looking at images. In the case of music, they're listening. But what they're not doing is retaining any copies. And in fact, it's true. The LLM model, once it's trained, is just a mathematical representation of what they call parameters, right? Which are different values that are set based on looking at a lot of Van Gogh pictures or something. They start to arrive at kind of an extrapolation. And there's a pretty strong argument there to say, all they're doing is measuring facts. They're looking at a picture and they're measuring facts. You know, what kind of values and colors and hues does Vincent Van Gogh use? We're not replicating Starry Night, but we have incredibly precise, maybe millions of measurements about that. Those are facts. Facts can't be copyrighted. Van Gogh's expression is one thing, but what we can recreate in the model is a factual representation of all those different values that go into creating that work. Now, I've talked a lot. I don't want to go on too long about this concept. I want to hear what you have to say, because that's going to be a pretty primary defense, I think, for some of these companies.
I know. Of course, it's going to be a primary defense. So first of all, I want to touch upon your point about, well, if I read this, I read Wirecutter, I make that recommendation. Well, isn't that the same thing? It's funny you mentioned that, because my newsletter today was exactly about that, about AI copying. No, AI copying is not the same as human copying. And the difference, again, gets back to markets like en masse, doing it on a grand scale to create a market that's like, this is the place to be. And when I'm an individual that's doing that, I'm not trying to compete on a broad base, making recommendations that, you know, compete with like Wirecutter. I'm not doing that. I think so. That's just part of it.
I see. So like if you and I were to publish a blog that was like the best of Wirecutter and we just summarized Wirecutter, we'd be asking for trouble because we'd be trying to create a destination that directly competes with Wirecutter.
No, I think that we can go real. If we continue this part of the conversation, that will probably take the whole time. I do want to get into the grander point of copying and such. So first of all, I think that. Remember, let's go back to policy.
Yeah,
of course, big tech. If I were big tech, that's what I would say too. And I think that there is a lot of, there certainly are data points in like Google Books, and that's why they rely upon it so much, that because they did line by line kind of copy.
Yeah, those were verbatim copies, and Google never disputed it. They just, their defense was fair use, that this is a fair transformative use of the original content.
Right. Here, there is something that has never been, as far as I know, anything that's been directly analogous to what we're talking about. But it's funny you asked me that. So I turned to Perplexity to ask that question. And I'll tell you what it says. Because first of all, the courts are going to decide what exactly copying means in this context. But at a high level, putting all these ingredients in, whatever the technology does with it, recombine, doing all this and, you know, taking these tokenized representations effectively to create reproductions or copies of the original copyrighted works within the LLM's parameters and memory, that just these recombinations itself could be seen as reproductions. So it's taking, you know,
that's the core argument that Matthew Buterick has made, right? So one of the cases that's been filed on behalf of Sarah Silverman, the comedian who wrote the book Bedwetter, and a bunch of other people in a class action lawsuit. And another case, which is called Anderson, which is a similar case, but it represents a lot of visual artists. One of them is named Anderson, but there's a bunch of artists in that class.
Right.
And the law firm there is Savieri, their class action lawsuit. So for the folks who are listening, these are the kind of hit and run attorneys who are in there to collect a huge amount of money, and then some tiny portion is going to get shared to the artist.
Okay, but look, I don't know that law firm, but just by saying it that way, Robert, I mean, let's be fair, you're dismissing the artist.
I'm having fun.
No, I know, but I gotta step in for the artist, like Sarah Silverman and the other artists, because just because the output isn't similar to what the input is.
It isn't similar at all. No, and it's not me saying that. That's what the judge in the matter said. The judge in the matter said if they can't show substantially similar content, then they have no case. And actually threw out most of those cases.
But substantial similarity is not on the input side. You don't need substantial similarity on the input side at all. Yeah. This gets to on the input. Remember, there's two, and everybody out there, this is really important. That a lot of people, when they make this argument, they just kind of bundle it all together and say there's no substantial similarities, so there's no copyright infringement. No, that's not the way the law works. The law works in this case, it looks at the input side and the output side. Yep. So on the output side, the New York Times has a very different argument than Sarah Silverman does.
They do.
The New York Times actually points to many different examples where there's near verbatim spitting out by the LLM.
Sure, but that's because the New York Times hacked the system and used it in ways that no human user would ever use it. Okay, so that's not going to hold up. And
I think that's a cute defense, but at the same time, it happened. So whether...
Sure. No, and OpenAI hasn't denied it. They have a blog on their website.
Whether it was hacked or not, but nonetheless, it happened. So I think that it shows that it's capable of doing that. That's the output side. Mm-hmm. On the input side itself, I think you go back to the... kind of the equities of it all, which is this is a novel question about what is copying in this context. It's a novel question. The court's going to decide that. So you mentioned kind of the way that big tech's looking at it, and it's an explanation, right? But it's nobody knows. You got to step back and say, what is fair? I think you look at what copyright policy is, and copyright policy, again, is about what's for the public good and what isn't, kind of net positive or net negative. In a situation like this, the reality is that none of this generative AI would have any value whatsoever unless it ingested these creative works, these copyrighted creative works. That's what gave it the value. Now, whether it did it like line by line or how exactly it did it, I'm not the engineer, but what Perplexity tells me is this. During this training process, the text from these copyrighted sources is broken down into smaller units called tokens.
Yep.
And then it says in some cases, it talks about these tokenized data sets derived from copyrighted materials and stored within the LLM can be considered reproductions under copyright law. That's what Perplexity tells me. Now, how it reached that explanation, we don't know exactly, but I think that the equities come into play of what the end game is here. This tech is very powerful and has a lot of great positive uses ultimately, but it gets into how we started this conversation. The only reason that it has value is by taking all these copyrighted works. And so if I'm an artist and my work has
anything. Nothing's being stolen. Sarah Silverman still has her book. She still owns the rights to Bedwetter. I don't think anybody is using ChatGPT to generate a copy of Bedwetter. I'd be stunned if there was any example of that. I don't think there is. Okay, let me do this.
But I think that
we keep jumping back and forth between
again, it's, but it's ultimately about market substitution. And that's
on the output side. Yes. So you're jumping output. Let me bring the input.
Market substitution is part of the fair use that comes into the input side.
Okay. So on the input side, the issue that I'm going to try to summarize Matthew Buterick's his argument. I'm not going to do it perfectly as well as he would. Yeah. So Matthew is one of the attorneys who is representing the plaintiffs in a couple of generative AI cases. And he's come up with what I think is a kind of a novel claim. He's saying, if you take a picture or if you look at a picture or you read a book and you generate all these minute measurements about it, at some level, if you have enough measurements, what you've done is you've made a kind of a new way to compress that information. And then he goes on to make the analogy to MP3s and JPEGs, which are also mathematical representations and a form of compression. Yeah. And so the complaint, this is on the side of the people who are filing the complaint, they're saying that LLMs are just a new form of compression. Now, I don't know the answer to that. You don't know the answer to that. That's going to be one of the cases that gets tested. Watch this space, because if that novel argument prevails, holy Toledo, it is going to upset the apple cart for all of the tech industry, because what they're doing is infringement on a massive scale. They're basically compressing down a ton of human output, you know, the greatest works of humanity. They're copying and compressing all of it. Now, again, I'm not making that argument. I don't buy that argument. That's some attorney's argument. I'm sort of parroting or paraphrasing what he said. But Peter, let's jump now to output side.
Can I say one thing on that point?
Sure, go ahead.
What you said is, this is more just a fun point, because we're here. And actually, this is a very interesting week in terms of culture with media tech. Apple just compressed the hell out of Creative Works in its advert.
What a tone-deaf commercial Apple made.
Video about its new iPad, and it literally crushed all of human creativity down to a thin iPad. Yeah. And so it's funny that we're talking about this and you mentioned it that way.
Yeah.
That is the way that creatives are feeling about it. And it's not because they want to stop the overall, like the progress in time. It's just saying, hey, again.
Well, I mean, hang on. The New York Times is asking for an injunction. They want to stop it. And they also want billions of dollars. And they want the court to rule them to destroy the model. So that sounds a lot like they're trying to stop it.
Well, they are trying to take a look at the overall pie that's created and get a piece that is fair. And you can define fairness differently than I do, but all I have to do is fast forward to what market caps are right now. And the only multi-trillion dollar companies out there are big tech. And a lot of that happened because of content, because Apple was only transformed into the company that it was because it started getting into the iTunes world and the iPod world. And there's a story there. And then YouTube and Google.
Yeah. Apple saved the music industry as a story because the music industry couldn't figure out how to do DRM, and Apple figured it out and saved them. So you're not going to argue. I hope you're not going to argue that they retroactively owe something extra to the record labels.
A lot of people think
they've been paying billions in royalties to record companies and artists.
No question, but Apple came in and certainly was a necessary solving of the pain and suffering that was going on. But the ultimate economics that resulted from that are, you know, they're a historical accident that we ended up coming up with like $9.99 album downloads, $9.99 streaming for 100 million songs, paying $9.99, which in the artist world really devalues the value of music. That was the big argument back then. But when
Spotify
really
is even worse. Spotify, you know, artists are doing thousands of streams and they're getting pennies back. Now, a lot of that money is collected by the labels and they don't necessarily share with the artists. That's not really on Spotify.
Yeah, I know. But first of all, I don't blame Spotify. I really don't, because Spotify just had its first profitable quarter. But the reality is, and my point of all this is that ultimate economics, when you're talking about media and tech, they're historical accidents. There is no right or wrong about any of these kind of things. It's a sharing of the pie and the equities involved. Ultimately, like YouTube.
I mean, but the point you're making is disproportionately the tech companies have benefited from the partnerships with content companies. That's no question about it.
And exhibit A is
Apple's way of doing it is, you know, they're not so concerned about content. They're concerned about the margins on hardware, because that's their real business.
Right.
And Apple drives historically high profit margins on hardware in the 30-something% range, which is unheard of. Most electronics have a 1 or 2%. You know, running electronics companies like running a grocery store. The margins are very tight. I know, I worked at Sony. Like, it's a brutal business. Apple is remarkable, but they do leverage content. They leverage the halo effect from great content to drive high profit margins.
They use content as marketing. And ultimately, the subliminal message from that advertisement was exactly that you take content is used as their advertising and it's smashed down into the iPad. That symbolizes everything.
Yeah. Okay. Really, so we got that point. Now we have a little time left. Let's talk about the output side. So we raised a bunch of issues. We haven't clarified, because folks, this stuff's going to be determined in a court in a year or two, and then it'll be appealed and appealed again. But now let's talk about the output side. So the output side is you or me using ChatGPT or using something like, Midjourney or some other generative AI app to do something. Now, the first thing I would start with there is what most people are doing is not making copies of Sarah Silverman's book or, you know, Jonathan Franzen's book. Like, I don't think anyone's actually doing that five paragraphs at a time. That is an absurd notion. But that's actually what some of these lawsuits claim. You read this, for instance, I'll give you a great example. When the Writers Guild strike was happening right down the street from my house, a lot of the signs lines there said ChatGPT is a plagiarism machine. And I'm like, first of all, you don't know what plagiarism is. Secondly, no, that's not what, no one's using it that way. It simply doesn't work like that. There is no plausible user scenario where someone's going to print out a 300-page book or a 90-page movie script prompting this thing, you know, prompt after prompt after prompt. That would be a ridiculous thing.
Okay, but Robert, I have to stop you. You know, I love the word choice of words you use that are inherently kind of slanted one way, but I'm trying. Look,
you busted me. I'm busted.
I gotta bust you. I mean, I have to, because here's the thing. Of course, if you look at Sarah Silverman's case, there's an input side and output side. The output side is going to be harder. Okay, I'll leave it at that. But if you're talking about like training an LLM to write a script that's based on 50 different scripts, let's say 50, not 10 million different scripts, let's say 10, 5, 10, 20. At what point, Robert, can the output actually be substantially similar?
Oh, we know the answer. We know the answer to that question because it's in the New York Times complaint. So the New York Times, just for the folks who haven't read it, it's actually both the New York Times complaint and then the response from OpenAI are really worth reading. Most of this stuff is a little bit dense, but those are two things that I would recommend people search and find because they're quite readable. And if you want to understand the issues on both sides, they're very, very comprehensible.
Yeah, they're not really long, actually.
No, they're not. And they're kind of entertaining. The response from OpenAI, I thought, was amusing. They're kind of playing to their grandstanding there as they respond. It's not really much of a legal response as much as it is for the audience. But the New York Times did this. They got someone to what OpenAI claims is that they hacked ChatGPT. And of course, the New York Times disputes that. But nevertheless, what the New York Times did is they constrained the model in such a way that they could produce effectively reproduce an article almost entirely. Right. So this looks a lot like, wow, it is a plagiarism machine from that viewpoint. But how they got that result is quite interesting. First, they pointed ChatGPT to a specific URL, which is that article. Then they fed the first seven paragraphs of the article in, effectively half the article. And they said, you know, what was the rest of the article? So, you know, what we're talking about is a prediction machine, right? This is a machine that is going to predict the statistically most likely next word in a sentence. That's how LLMs work, how large language models work. But if you constrain that machine so much that you're basically saying you can only find stuff from this one source and we're going to give you all this input in the prompt, you can constrain the model such that the only probable outcome is going to be to complete the sentence or complete the article in this instance. But in my view, first of all, that's an absurd example because no one's ever going to do that. If you have the first seven paragraphs from Wirecutter or whatever article it is, you're never going to go to ChatGPT and get the rest of the article.
I hate to interrupt you, but I got to stop you because the fact that it is capable of having an output that is substantially similar, even if I concede that that is the test when it comes to this new context, which we don't know. There's still going to be a fair use analysis on the output side too.
Yep.
So of course you can characterize it as being an absurd case that nobody would do it this way or whatever, but nonetheless, the sausage factory can create it this way. And whether that's going to be necessary to be exactly the same or spit out something verbatim, or is there going to be a new kind of test that says that, you know, this kind of summarizes this thing that this article that New York Times had five journalists on in Afghanistan and, you know, on the West Bank or whatever, and they spent millions of dollars over 6 months' time in creating this feature story. And even if the output from an LLM is not necessarily verbatim or this or that, and it's some kind of close summary, however you define that, and a court's going to have to do it that way, there's still market substitution at the end of the day. And
that's going to be a fair use factor. I agree. But for folks who are listening, remember, it is okay to write your own summary in your own words of somebody else's book or somebody else's document. That is a completely acceptable thing.
But you're also an individual. You're not a business that is enabling billions of people to be able
so
to do
you're that. Right. The profit motive is going to weigh heavily against them.
And also it's a system rather than an individual doing it.
But again, my argument, what worth is my argument? We're just two guys talking to each other on a podcast. But my view on this matter is that no user is actually going to use it to try to replicate a New York Times article or Sarah Silverman's fabulous tome, Bedwetter. It just seems unlikely that you would use that tool to do that. Now, but bear in mind, if someone were to do it, that would be infringement. It'd be willful infringement. If they said, give me Sarah Silverman's paragraph by paragraph, give me Sarah Silverman's book, Bedwetter, that's on the end user. That's not necessarily on the company that's providing the LLM or the system. And this is the this brings us to the Sony Betamax case from 1984, determined by the Supreme Court, where they said as long as there are substantial non-infringing uses of a videotape recorder, then you can't hold the manufacturer of that equipment accountable. The distinction here, though, and you know they're going to use that case and they're going to try to use that as a defense, but the distinction here is that Sony wasn't operating the equipment. And here it gets really murky because these are all these LLMs are offered as a software as a service in the cloud. It's hosted by these other companies.
Sony also wasn't doing what's happening here, which is taking all these copyrighted works. That's not what Sony was doing. Individuals were doing it. So this is very much, Betamax is very much like the MP3 kind of example we talked about before, mm-hmm. where it was a no-no when Robertson or whoever it was kind of brought in all these works, created this system in the cloud where you could, if you could verify that you owned it yourself, then that should be Michael Felt. That should be something that's legal. And the courts or somebody slammed that down and saying, no, it's different because you were taking the content yourself, not the individual. I think the same kind of rationale here applies.
Yeah. And also they're going to say, you know, the tech companies are going to say, we didn't know that that's how they were using it. And here are the cases. This is going to be a very tough one to defend because they do know what people are inputting as prompts. They have a way to know that. And in the New York Times case, OpenAI disclosed that they are aware of this problem. So they do have they have dirty hands in that matter. So it's not as clear cut as the Sony Betamax case.
No, I think not at all. That. Here's my ultimate prediction. When this does ultimately through one of these cases go to the Supreme Court, I think the Warhol case where they found this kind of market substitution, mm-hmm. Commercial harm to creators test or kind of an asterisk on the fair use argument. I think that's going to be ultimately what kind of saves the day. But, you know, that's for on the copyright infringement analysis. But, you know, here's the thing. And because you asked this even before the session, one of the questions that you had was, OK, if somebody went, if big tech wins, what happens to licensing?
Yeah, that's what I want to know.
If big media wins, what happens to licensing? Ultimately, either way, there's going to be compensation. And if I'm fast forwarding, there's going to be compensation of some kind for anybody whose their creative works are find their way into a training data set. And then I do believe there will also be some kind of opt-in, depending on who wins or loses, or opt-out system where somebody, a creator can decide whether they want to be, at least they can say no.
OpenAI is already offering a tool that does that. And I think Google has something similar. So yeah, the tech companies are one step ahead here. They know what they need to do to come out of this looking a little bit better. But Peter, here's the wild card. There's 500,000 open source models available today on Hugging Face. Yeah. So, you know, who's going to police this? This is like whack-a-mole for the content companies. Are you going to go chase down every one of the people? Those are open source, meaning millions of people can use these tools. They're already trained. Yeah. How should they track this down and manage it? Maybe OpenAI comes up with something like Content ID. You've suggested that. I see that. Maybe Google does that. They've already done it for YouTube. For the folks who are listening, Content ID is a system that allows copyright owners to find their works that are being shown on YouTube.
On YouTube only, closed.
And then they have the option to either monetize that content. If it was illegally uploaded, they can put an ad in front of it, or they can take it down. By the way, that system is riddled with flaws because you know all about copyright fraud and false takedown notices and so forth. But nevertheless, there is a possibility that there's some system.
Okay, so can I touch on that question that you
asked? Do, yeah.
So first of all, I think the winner in this kind of forensic tracking and payment system, I don't think it's going to be any one of the big tech companies that we know today. I know one company in particular that I can't mention that has a real shot at being that kind of Swiss solution to be able to do that.
But the content ID type of solution.
Content ID sort of thing. Yes, exactly. It tracks, identifies whether something's been sucked into the vortex and then makes a payment, right?
A lot of companies are trying to get into that idea right now. And, you know, Fox has their own version that they're introducing. So, yeah, that's a lively space right now.
But you mentioned, and it's so true, you look back, well, there's all these open source. So there's all these solutions. How do you police it? I think you got to look back at what happened in the music space with Napster and all that, where there was no way that you could, it was a whack-a-mole strategy just to litigate. So ultimately, the music world had to come up with some kind of better, something that was a better solution for consumers. And I think that the unsatisfying answer to many out there may be that there's going to be a lot of things that you're not going to be able to chase down and will be, you know, taking your works and you'll be receiving no compensation. But the goal here is to create a system that is a more equitable system that's going to be so much better for the end user that they will gladly pay something to use that rather than something that's just free.
You're right. And just for the folks who are listening, let me build on what Peter just said. We were talking about, as an analogy, the Napster incident. So Napster was introduced in 1999 or 2000. It started to really gain traction. And from 2000 till 2010, the music industry saw its revenue collapse by a factor of 75%. So it wiped out the music industry in just 10 years. Napster, they managed to stop. They shut it down. But then it was followed immediately by Grokster, which was serverless. There was no central controlling thing. There was no one to chase for that. And then it was followed by eDonkey and eMule, et cetera, et cetera. So all these different versions of filing sharing software that came around. What finally put an end to it, first of all, was the iPod, where Apple made it possible to get licensed music legally for a very reasonable price. People seemed to like that. And so that was one solution. But then ultimately, streaming, by the end of the decade, became the solution. It's like, why bother having a collection of MP3s moldering on a hard drive when you can have access to everything for a cheap monthly fee, which is where we are today. So,
right, you know,
it's a 10-year cycle.
No, exactly. The interesting thing about all of that is that you had the original bad Napster come in. And of course, the artists were not being compensated for anything. And as you said, Steve Jobs came in. He was the white knight. He solved the problem, created he was in the power position because of that. And so economics resulted as a result of that power and that unbalance of power. But nonetheless, it was a positive step because artists were finally getting compensated.
Well, and the brilliance of Apple is that they came up with an encryption scheme so that you were not listening to an MP3 file that was unencrypted, but the encryption was tied to Apple devices. So that's where they were able to steal the value from the media companies, from the record labels, and it drove Apple to great success. You know, back in 2000, I mentioned that as a starting point of the Napster meltdown for the music industry. In 2000, Apple was worth $5 billion as a company, and it was on its last legs. They had less than 3% share in the market of personal computers. And this is, of course, long before the iPhone, but they did introduce the iPod.
Yeah.
And this idea of tying music to the iPod through DRM, through digital rights management, is what saved Apple. And it's a remarkable story.
Completely transformed that. And by the way, it was my little company, Music Match, that created the software that allowed them to go into the world of Windows. And then so for the iPod, it was actually our technology. And then we were jettisoned.
I did not know that.
No, it was very cool. But one thing, this is the reason why I raised that.
Yeah.
So Napster came in, the bad Napster. Economics completely changed. It did. The reality is that in consumers' new generation's mind, it devalued music because all of a sudden music was free. And so one of the vestiges of that is that we're in a world where we're able to have, now it's like $12.99 a month, but for up until a couple of years ago, it was $9.99 a month for 100 million songs. Now, if you look at that equitably, and if you really stand back objectively, that's an amazing value, And that leads to the economics and the sharing and the pain that we, you know, some of the conversations we had today.
This is why musicians have a terrible time right now, because they're not making very much of that $9.99 a month. They're getting pennies. Labels are getting dollars.
The reason why this historical journey is so important is because with Gen AI, this is not a new thing. We saw it happen when it came to the music side of music industry, then with the motion picture industry with streaming. And these are historical accidents. It's new technology created. And it's about dividing the pie ultimately.
I get you. No, you're making the point very eloquently, but you made it. I mean, I get it. And I think you're right. There has to be a way for artists to survive and get paid something. But where I'm focused here is I want to look at the end of the story, because what we talked about is a 10-year transition for the music industry, where they went from selling shiny discs that happened to contain music. And at the end of that process, and 10 years later, they were doing subscription content services where it was completely dematerialized and people could subscribe to one service and get access to everything instead of collecting shiny discs or collecting MP3 files on their computer. That transformed the entire music business. And I would argue that transformation continues because now artists have moved into live music, better live productions than they ever did before, because that's where the money is. This is a 20-year cycle. Okay, so now let's look forward 20 years into the future and let's consider what happens here. And I will give you, I'll give you a starting point. I think the whole issue that we're talking about here is that we're talking about fixed works. These original works, these copyrighted works are fixed works delivered in fixed media. And what LLMs are doing is transforming those fixed works into something that is participatory, that masses of people, and I mean billions of people, can interact with to build new creative things. There's a lot of issues there. Is that a derivative work? Should the artist who created the original work get paid a royalty off of those things? These are huge open questions, right?
Yeah, they're huge.
But where I'm driving is maybe this notion of a fixed work that is copyrighted for a century, because that's what we have right now, this absurdly extended, distended copyright term, maybe that notion is going to change. And maybe what media has to turn into is something that is more open, more participatory, something that enables audiences to actually play with and mess with and participate meaningfully. With
well, no, amen. But I think absolutely right. And I'll give you an example where I think that's massive opportunity. And I'm all for it so long as the artists, the creator themselves, want to be a part of it. They should have control of whether they want to enable their fans, as an example, to build on top of their work. But if they do, there's a whole new opportunity. And a great example of that is Grimes. So artist Grimes, she was married to Elon Musk. Musk was married to her. Artist Grimes is somebody I've followed forever. She's always been an innovator. What she did very early on after ChatGPT, and it's pretty amazing, she created something called Elf Tech, which makes her, the stems of her songs, as well as her voice, available to anybody out there to freely play on and build on top of and build their own stuff. Her only caveat to that is if a song starts getting commercially valuable, she shares 50% of the revenues and royalties that come from it. Yeah. So there's an entirely new model. And what's cool about that is that it, for Grimes, it's not cannibalizing her works. It's allowing her brand to continue on. She delights her fans because they're able to create new music, some of which could be, you know, she felt that something was really good, as an example. She gets a new revenue stream. And I would say that in a Grimes kind of case, that almost builds her audience when she creates her own 100% Grimes music, even though there's all this other music that's 100%. Flooded up.
Open it up and let the audience play with you. You'll find super fans, right? Not everybody's going to create great stuff, but some will.
But the artist should be in control of that decision. But always, so as an example, everything that we've talked about, streaming has enabled new ways for artists to create communities for themselves, enlarge their base, to engage more deeply with their base, for sure, which enables them to monetize in other ways that weren't available 20 years ago. So technology transforms the status quo and how it's monetizing today. I would say the big takeaway, Robert, is that, and this is what I advise creatives all the time, young creatives, is it's critical for you not just to be a creator, but to be an entrepreneur, to really play with these tools, understand them, learn about them, or get people on your team who does them so that you understand that there's maybe not $100 out there in one bucket, but there's little pieces here and there and everywhere, and you're delighting your fans more and maybe getting a chance to be closer to them. And that monetizes too, not only digitally, but also leads to bigger shows, more merch, things like that. And so
I love it. And I am a believer in that. I think these tools are going to make it possible for us to do things we never could have dreamed of. They're going to enable people who are not necessarily considering themselves creative today to find novel ways to express themselves, maybe new kinds of mashups or new types of expression that we can't even imagine today. We had Imogen Heap on as a guest. She's another great artist who's very, leans into technology. And I invited her on because she said something to me that blew my mind. We were talking about whether she was concerned about having her voice cloned by one of these AI systems. And she said, I can't wait to meet my AI. I can't wait to hear the songs it will sing to me. And I thought that was such an artistic way of thinking about this technology. Like, she's not afraid of it at all. She's like, I want to meet that version of myself, that digital version. Well, Peter, it's been a great pleasure having you on the show, man. I really enjoyed it. How can people find you on the web? Tell us what the best places to find you and read your thoughts are.
Yeah. First of all, Robert, I really enjoyed it too, because I know we could go on and on. You didn't even ask me about what the world's going to look like 20, 30 years from now. And I had a great...
We have a minute. Go for it.
I think it's critical. Okay. I think that 20, 30 years from now, the kids of today are tired. They're over the fact that everything's so digital. So I think there's going to be a return to more tangible. I think there's going to be more of like getting out in nature. I think AI is going to be fixing some of the mega problems out there. And I also think that the young people are tired of the geriatrics who are setting the rules of the game. So I'm very optimistic in young minds who are going to take everything that we're dealing with today and are reimagining what life should be. That is more like less heads down and digital and less like social media and less and more interactive and actual tangible living with each other and active relationships with real people looking up rather than just looking down. That's my big prediction.
All right, man, that sounds good to me. And I welcome that vision. Folks, you've been listening to The Futurists. I'm Rob Tursik. My guest this week has been Peter Chadi. As you can see from our conversation, there's an awful lot that we could talk about. I'd love to have you back to talk about
I'd love to.
Positive vision in the future.
You asked me how they can find me. So you can find me at creativemedia.biz. That's my firm, creativemedia.biz. My work, I have two different newsletters. The most important one for these purposes is called The Brain, B-R-A-I-N, on Substack. You can find it. And then also I write a weekly column in The Wrap, so you'll be able to find me there.
Excellent. And we will both be on stage doing more of this on May 20 in New York at Streaming Media in New York. So we hope to see you there if you're in New York City. Super to see you, Peter. I can't wait to meet you in person. And thanks for joining us on The Futurists. As a wrap up, I just want to thank the folks who make the show possible, our friends at Provoke Media, and of course, Kevin Hirsharn, who I've kept up late tonight because this show went super long. Thank you, Kevin, for making us sound great. And Lisbeth Severns, our producer, and everyone who supports the show. But mainly, we are grateful to our friends who listen to the show and the people who share with us on social media and who give us suggestions and ideas. I met Peter through social media. That's how we got this show started. This happens all the time. It's one of the great things about doing a podcast is you get to meet cool people who are thoughtful. And I love that kind of expression and that kind of engagement. We want to hear from you. So please reach out to us on the socials. We are The Futurists, and we will see you in the future. Well, that's it for The Futurists this week. If you liked the show, we sure hope you did. Please subscribe and share it with the people in your community. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review. That really helps other people find the show. And you can ping us anytime on Instagram and Twitter at Futurist Podcast for the folks that you'd like to see on the show or the questions that you'd like us to ask. Thanks for joining. And as always, we'll see you in the future.
Thank you for listening to the latest Irish Tech News podcast. Check back every day for the latest episode. You can follow us on Twitter @Irish_Tech News, on Facebook, facebook.com/Irish Tech News, on LinkedIn, linkedin.com/company/Irish-Tech-News, on Instagram, instagram.com/IrishTechNews.ie, and on TikTok, tiktok.com/@IrishTechNews.